Jimmy Carter has received high praise for his post-White House work, somewhat in contrast to criticism he received while he was president. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll listen back to some of our favorite conversations from 2015. One of those, as you may have guessed, was with former President Carter. He discussed the high number of presidential candidates, the nuclear deal with Iran, and his legacy. Plus, Roseanne Cash is a Grammy-winning musician and part of one of the most famous musical families in the U.S. We talked about her creative inspirations and what's changed about her art over the years. Also, a conversation with Pastor Warren Stewart, who helped lead the charge for a holiday honoring Martin Luther King in Arizona. And humorist and former Valley resident Lori Notaro brought back some of her favorite Arizona-centered columns. The special year-end edition of Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. On this special holiday edition of the program, we'll treat you to some of our favorite conversations of 2015. That includes humorist Lori Notaro and musician Roseanne Cash. We start today's program by returning to a conversation I had in July with former President Jimmy Carter. His new autobiography, A Full Life, had just been published. This was also before he was diagnosed with melanoma, which earlier this month he said had been cured. We started by discussing why so many candidates, Republican and Democrat, think they should be the next president of the U.S.
Well, I had about a dozen that ran against me in 1976, including President Ford and Ronald Reagan on the other side, so there were about 14 in all. So I don't think this is an extraordinary number, and of course they'll be weaned out pretty rapidly because nowadays the main crux of staying in the race is raising, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and as you know, that's going to be limited to a small number of Republicans and Democrats.
You'd worked so hard to try to achieve peace in the Middle East between Egypt and Israel at that time. What does it take? Is there a true possibility of achieving a lasting peace in the Middle East? And what would it take? What factors would need to occur for that to happen?
Well, I would say that now is the lowest point in my political career time that we've ever seen in the prospects for an immediate progress being made between Israel and its immediate neighbors, that is primarily the Palestinians. The United States has practically no influence in either Jerusalem or in Ramallah or Gaza, and we don't have any inclination apparently on the part of the Israeli government now to take the initiative toward peace relating to the Palestinians. So I would say that it's more of a dormant relationship now than I've remember in my lifetime. We don't have any move by other people, particularly the European countries, to replace the United States as the interlocutor or the mediator. And I think the Netanyahu government has made it plain, particularly with this newly formed, more conservative government, that they don't have any inclination to move toward a two-state solution, which was a premise or the assumption that we would have back in those days. So I think I had a much better prospect when I became president to make some progress than seems to exist at this moment.
What do you think of the nuclear deal with Iran, and how could that affect the Middle East situation overall?
I think it could be very helpful. I'm fully in favor of it. I believe it's a wonderful agreement there on the part of the United States of America, the entire world, and even the Iranians. And my hope is that it'll go into effect and that the Congress will not be able to veto what John Kerry has done so assiduously and so well. I have complete confidence in John Kerry's negotiating ability and also his toughness. And his when he tells me that he has an agreement and if Iran violates it, they'll be severely punished by an immediate imposition of the economic sanctions, I believe him completely, and I think that we have the agreement that can make this come about, no matter what other countries might think about it.
None of us can be psychiatrists in this situation, but for people who came of age in the late 70s, early 80s, when we first saw the face of Ayatollah Khomeini and how terrifying that was to people, does it make sense to you that there are some people who, when they hear anything with Iran, they're wary?
I don't think it's incorrect to be wary. I wouldn't say that we need to trust Iran, but I think with the agreement that has now been consummated, at least by the executive branch of our government, and by the Europeans, and by China, and by Russia as well. We have a very good measuring stick on whether Iran violates the agreement that they've reached. So I think we have a very good situation. When the Shah was overthrown in Iran when I was in office, which was a surprise to all the intelligence agencies and to the general public, I immediately established diplomatic relations with the Ayatollah's revolutionary government. And it was those diplomats that I sent over to Tehran that were captured and made prisoner. They had an almost equal number that they had sent over to Washington to represent them and our country. So we immediately established diplomatic relations with Iran when the Shah was overthrown.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with former President Jimmy Carter. Now, President Carter, your post-presidential commitments and accomplishments have been far-reaching. You're considered to be the most impressive former president after your four-year presidential term had happened. How do you measure the criticism you received in one position and the high praise you receive in another? Is that just human nature? How do you explain that?
Well, there was a lot of praise when I was president, too, when we normalized diplomatic relations with China, when we consummated the Panama Peace Agreement, when we started doing away with apartheid in South Africa, when we got peace between Israel and Egypt, when we formed a very strong and active energy policy that was kind of comprehensive in nature, when we dealt with the Alaska lands problems. All of those were notable achievements, but the main thing was that we had the Iran hostage crisis, which I could not resolve early in my term. And the last 3 days I was president, I never went to bed at all, never tried to go to bed. I just negotiated constantly with Iran and about 12 other countries. And we got an agreement from the Iranians that they would release all our hostages. They were in an airplane at the end of their runway in Tehran, ready to take off from early that morning. But for some reason, which I never have tried to explain, the Ayatollah kept them in prison in Iran in an airplane until after I was no longer president. So there were a lot of things that came up, but I think in general we had enough successes when I was in office, and also some issues that I tried to address unsuccessfully, which I've mentioned very meticulously in the new book I've written.
President Carter, I don't know if you would have seen a new play, a relatively new play called Five Presidents, and it fictionalizes what could have happened when you and the other four living presidents were at President Nixon's funeral. There's an example of just having the five of you, or anyone who's ever been president, having that the knowledge that none of the rest of us will ever have, and the experience you go through. You talk about not sleeping, trying to negotiate to get the hostages out, when different presidents have sent men and women into war, and what that feels like when you find out people have died. Can any of us who haven't been president actually understand what it's like to have been president?
I doubt that. You know, we all go through trying and exciting and challenging and adventurous, unpredictable times. I was determined to keep our country at peace while I was in office, and I was lucky enough to be able to do it. When I was in the White House, we never dropped a bomb, we never launched a missile, we never fired a bullet at another country, another people, and that's one of the rare times that's happened. But I think that every president, when he goes into office, would like to keep our country at peace and would like to honor human rights and would like to meet the major challenges that arise. And we are all different from one another. We're just as different as, you know, five different people you might meet on the street. And when we get in office, we have challenges to meet. And that's what I try to do in this book, is not only tell about some of the lessons I've learned in my life, but maybe some of the lessons will be beneficial to people that read the book. And one of the things I do is delineate all the things that I was able to completely resolve when I was president, and some of the things that I was not able to resolve. And I also described at the end of the book my relationship personally with all the presidents that served before me that I knew, and also those that have served since I left the White House. So the book is jam full of things that I believe our country could do. I think I also describe what a superpower should do and what our country should have as its present commitments for the future.
Well, what are some of the responsibilities of the superpower?
I think our country is capable and should strive to be a champion of peace, not war. I think we should be a champion of democracy and freedom. we should be a champion of the quality of the environment in dealing with global warming and other challenges that arise. Be also a champion of human rights. And we should set an example among the rich nations of the world in sharing as much of our resources as is good for us and for poor people with those who are in need. So those are the championships that our superpower should exemplify, set an example for other nations to emulate.
In terms of public life, can you explain to us what you want your legacy to be, what you most want to be remembered for, in terms of not what your family remembers about you, but what the broader public would remember about you?
One is peace and human rights. I think that after the Second World War, the international community reached a pinnacle of ambition to exemplify in public life the basic moral principles of all the great religions, and also the moral principles that an average person has. And that was done with the United Nations commitment to have peace instead of war, and also the passage of a Universal Declaration of Human Rights a few years later, which I think was the highest possible expression of the ideals of human behavior. So those two things are what I've tried to champion in my life in public office and also since I left the White House about 35 years ago.
You've been very open about your religious faith and spirituality. You obviously were when you were running for president. It seems like such an important part now of every candidate. Do you think that should be important when voters are considering whom to vote for? Because we'll hear from some critics who feel like, well, it's out there because some candidates feel like they have to say it, and yet there are some who feel it's a little bit disingenuous among some.
I tried to avoid it, as a matter of fact, but I was asked a question when I was campaigning in North Carolina, and I answered it, and of course the news media thought that I was a weirdo or something, that I got my instructions from heaven and things of that kind. But when I got to be president, I implemented quite severely the principle that I had learned as a child from my father, and that is a complete separation of church and state. So I terminated the policy then of inviting Billy Graham and other famous preachers into the White House, and I very carefully drew a delineation or a line between my role as a private worshiper in the nearest Baptist church to the White House and my role as a president. And I never have thought that any president should espouse the United States as a Christian nation or things of that kind. I think we should treat everybody in our country, whether they're Jewish or Christian or Muslim or Buddhist or whatever, or even has no belief, on an equal basis.
That was former President Jimmy Carter. I spoke with him in July of this year. This special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now continues. Up next, my conversation with Pastor Warren Stewart on his efforts to bring a Martin Luther King Day holiday to Arizona. Then later this hour, my interviews with musician Roseanne Cash and humorist Lori Natero. Stay tuned. This is a special edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're listening back to some of our favorite interviews of 2015. Nearly three decades ago, Evan Meekum became Arizona's governor, and it didn't take long for him to generate national controversy. Meekum rescinded the order of his predecessor, Bruce Babbitt, that declared a holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Arizona. It took a number of years and conflicting ballot measures, but Arizona eventually became the first state with a voter-approved King Day. One of the leaders in making that a reality is Reverend Warren Stewart, longtime pastor of the First Institutional Baptist Church in Phoenix. He tells the story of the holiday coming to fruition in his new book, Victory Together, for Martin Luther King Jr. We started our conversation by talking about Governor Babbitt's visit to First Institutional Baptist Church.
It was Sunday, May 18th, 1986. Bruce Babbitt came to our 8 o'clock service at that time, and he said, I want to declare this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday from the pulpit of the First Institutional Baptist Church. Art Hamilton was there. He was minority speaker. Many other community leaders were there, and it was history.
So at the time, were you celebrating? Were you thinking, this is good news, but this doesn't mean the end of the story?
Well, it was good news, but Governor Babbitt said something in his presentation. He said, now, I'm doing this, but you're going to have to fight for this. So it's kind of, he knew in the back of his mind that he might have been on shaky ground, and he said, you're going to have to fight for this. We didn't know what kind of fight he meant, but it turned out to be a 6.5-year fight.
Then take us through when Governor Meekum came in, and if it wasn't his first act, it was one of his early acts to rescind that order. Initial reaction by you and the community, how did people feel?
State Attorney General Corbin at the time was Republican, and he said that Governor Babbitt did not have the authority to do it. But of course, he was the governor. So when Governor Meekum won that election when nobody thought he would win in November 1986, I guess a news reporter asked him, you know, you said you would rescind the King holiday. Are you going to do it? He said, yes, I am. I'm going to rescind the King holiday. It's not legal. And Martin Luther King Jr. is not at the statue of presidents Washington and Lincoln. And so we met with him shortly after he won the election in several state leaders from around the state. There were African Americans, clergy. There was a Jewish rabbi leaders there. And we tried to get him to say no, you know, to not rescind. He said, no, I'm going to rescind. He said, you never get, you black people don't need a holiday. You folks need jobs.
Was Meekum a racist?
I called him a racist. I called him a racist. I believe he was.
Okay.
I believe he was.
Do you think that matters in the big picture when we look back at this
story?
Well,
I mean, America is ingrained with systemic racism. And so if he wasn't a racist, he was part of a systemic racist system that discriminated against people of color for centuries, mm-hmm. for decades. So, yeah.
Was this a community that had talked about systemic racism any more than any other community? Was there a feeling that the population wasn't so great, that people weren't giving it as much attention as maybe you thought they should?
Well, even Governor Babbitt, who was considered an ally of people of color, of African Americans, he would throw up in our face when we would meet with him, African American leaders, well, you know, you all are only 3%. Mm. And he would just, I mean, and he was an ally. So if as an ally, he brought up, you're only 3%. You know, and when we try to get him to do things on public education, economic development. So that was around, but see, the whole genesis of the King holiday is that Martin Luther King helped America live out its constitution, mm-hmm. its founding fathers' dream in some respects for liberty and justice for all. And so we had to move people to understand this is not a black holiday. This is an American holiday. Mm-hmm.
Do you see people viewing Martin Luther King Jr. in a different way now than they did 30 years ago? And I mean even just the average middle-class white person.
Well, certainly, because when we started, polls were taken, and 70% of Arizonans did not support the King holiday. Mm-hmm. So from that 6.5-year period from when it was declared in the pulpit of the First Assembly Baptist Church, when we finally won on November 3rd, 1992, we had to move people 100%, or we moved them 100% in the opposite direction. By the time it won by 66%, which was 2-1. Mm-hmm. But the key was to educate people that Martin Luther King helped America to be the real America its founders intended it to be, mm-hmm. liberty and justice for all. And we were successful, thank God, and moved people.
Considering what people were saying to you about, well, this is a black holiday or this is a brown holiday, why did you think it was important to fight in that bigger sense and not just say, I'm going to say my piece? And why did you feel the need to be a leader on this?
Because I felt that Dr. King's legacy and ministry and contribution to the nation had been insulted. Mm. Insulted, perhaps, not out of meanness, but ignorance. Mm. And so I saw this as an assignment to elevate people's understanding and perception of the significance of Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement. So for me, it was a mission.
What really turned the tide after 5.5, 6 years?
Money. The boycotts, the Super Bowl, the conventions and events, concerts that canceled here. First one, Stevie Wonder down in Tucson, January of 1987, and it steamrolled, snowballed. But the ultimate one was in 1989-ish, when we were trying to get the Super Bowl here in 1993. And my dear good friend now, Bill Shover was the chair of the Super Bowl committee, and he responded and said, "Reverend, I would like us to talk." It was money that got the powers that be on board to push this. And of course, it didn't happen all of a sudden, because it was passed twice in the legislature, overturned by referendum, put on the ballot in 1990, two different ones, defeated, but finally in 92, it was overwhelmingly.
When we think about money sort of turning the tide on things, does motive matter or does the outcome matter?
I had a challenge working with the Phoenix 40 when we finally did work together and the business community, because I always question, do they really want this for the right reason, or do they want this because this is the only way Arizona can join that elite club of cities in the nation that host the Super Bowl? And to be very frank, I think the majority worked with us for the Super Bowl, but there were converts along the way.
How important is a boycott as an element of these things for people to really see the light?
Well, as a disciple of both Jesus Christ and Martin Luther King Jr., I studied the way Martin King led the civil rights movement. And there were progressive steps. You speak with the powers that be. Once you identify there's a racial issue, you try to get them to come on board. If that doesn't work, then you lobby them. You build your support base. If that doesn't work, then you have public demonstrations when that doesn't work. And on down, and about the fifth step is an economic boycott. And if they don't do the first four steps, then you move to the boycott. And after the boycott is civil disobedience. And we were almost at the point of about to be arrested for the King holiday, but that's when the business community got involved and they came on board. But we were planning civil disobedience because we didn't think that the boycott was working, but it began to work as it mounted up. Yeah.
The name of the book is Victory Together. The author is Reverend Warren Stewart of First Institutional Baptist Church in Phoenix. Always a pleasure to have you here. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. God bless you.
I recorded that interview with Pastor Stewart in May. There are general perceptions of what it means to be a feminist and be a female who takes an independent path and doesn't limit herself based on traditional conventions or what men may have determined is right or correct. That wouldn't seem to jibe with more conservative religious faiths or groups. But Hannah Goldstein, no relation, the blogger behind Reclaiming Pink, is a feminist and a member of the Orthodox Jewish denomination. I spoke with her in September, and our conversation began with a question about the perception that it would be difficult for someone to be Orthodox and a feminist.
I think I'm Orthodox because I'm a feminist. I grew up very secular, and I grew up in a home with a really strong, powerful mom who gave me amazing values. She told me that I could do anything that I wanted. When I kind of got out into that big, wide world, I was like, okay, I know that being a woman doesn't mean that I'm less than, and it doesn't mean that I'm going to be discriminated against. It doesn't mean all these negative things. But what does it mean? So that was really what I was looking for. I was kind of looking to fill that void. And I started meeting really strong, empowered women, a lot of whom who were Orthodox Jewish in my faith. And I took a look at them. I took a look at the tools that they had, that they used in their families and in their lives, their relationships. And I was like, I want that.
There's the power and the strength. And I think an average person would say, okay, I see that. What about individuality? The idea that there are certain things you have to follow, is that taking away at all from what comes inside from you?
It's funny. I think my students will tell you that there isn't another rabbi's wife on the planet who is like me. And they're probably all laughing right now. I'll tell you like this. I think that when people say that they subscribe to a religion, I think that they kind of misunderstand. I don't submit to a religion. I think that what's really important for me, the way that I understand it, is that it's not I take myself and I apply myself to Judaism. It's that I take my Judaism and apply it to my life. It is tools which help me achieve in so many different ways. So I have my agenda, my individuality, the things I want to get done, mm-hmm. as you can see on my website, Reclaiming Pink. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a big, loud voice, and those are all the things that I want to change in the world. And I use my Judaism and my religion, my faith, those tools in order to make that happen.
As you mentioned, your husband is not just Orthodox, he's a rabbi.
Right. I married a rabbi.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's you really took the plunge. So how does that dynamic work? Is there equal parts power? Do you have influence here? He has it there. How do you team up?
So you should know that right now my husband is at home cooking a rodeo barbecue dinner for probably about 150 students whilst I am here on the radio talking to you about feminism. So, I mean, we run a very, very equal house. We're incredibly 50-50. I think that I might have achieved that over and above a lot of my secular friends, and I feel very, very lucky for that. My husband is incredibly supportive of everything that I do, and I think that because we have this relationship of understanding that there are two amazing energies in this relationship, we both get so much done, both individually and together, and we're incredibly supportive.
Was there a bumpiness there to begin with? Because I would think if you were the same person at that point that you are right now, clearly not silent, not a wallflower, obviously
right.
quite confident. Was he tentative at all? That is this going to work at all based on what some expectations are for others of that sect, perhaps?
I don't think so. When we first met, I was 19 and secular. I had hair like maybe like an inch long. I was definitely very militant and very loud. And that's when he first met me. That's when we both went on a trip to Israel. And he was also secular at the time. And we had a holiday romance. It was very romantic. And then after that, we kind of went our separate ways. He stayed in Israel to learn. I came back and finished up my law degree, and then only afterwards went to Israel. And when we were set up later, it kind of was a really natural fit. He's a really strong Jewish leader. I'm a really, hopefully, really strong Jewish leader. And we both complement each other like that.
So law degree, you slip that in.
Yes.
People will hear, okay, here's an intense, intelligent female lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't seem to get more powerful than that. And yet, based on what you're saying, it is what you, this path you chose is more powerful than that would have been. What made you decide that being a lawyer, being in that group was not enough, let's say?
So when I graduated university, when I graduated out of my law degree, I have to tell you, I was incensed. Incensed is about the best word I have for it. I was disgusted with some of the laws that existed, some of the ways in which women were treated in the criminal justice system with regards to domestic violence. We have women who are going into the courts having been accused of domestic violence against a husband who has been beating them for years. Yet husbands will get off on a domestic violence charge. Why? Because they snap. Like, there is a moment at which they just snap, and in England, in any sense, they sometimes can get off on a charge of temporary insanity. A woman doesn't usually snap. As one of my law professors put it, she's on a slow burn. So she gets down for premeditated murder. Mm-hmm. You know, like, she also sometimes doesn't even have the strength to snap. So some of these things, also a lot of the mental health provision and mental health laws, I was just incensed. So I turned around and I said, I'm not interested in applying this law. I'm interested in changing it. So I worked in politics for a while, and it still just wasn't big enough for me at that point, wasn't powerful enough. And so when my husband came out to England, before he was my husband, and we had a chance meeting, it was kind of, I'd say it was love at first sight, or at least second sight in this case. And I really saw what an incredible person he'd become. And I was like, you know what? I want to partner with this guy and make a difference in the world.
Now, you were a young woman. You were 19. And you mentioned you had very short hair and you were very intense. You were very secular.
Right.
So do you have personality traits that would lend you to be, if I'm secular, I'm going secular and I am Orthodox and I'm Orthodox. Is that something we can pick up with your personality, that one leads to the other? The idea that if you're going to be involved in one or the other, you're going to really throw yourself into it. This is not going to be, I'm Orthodox, okay, I'm sort of blasé about it.
To me, and I think this is your question, to me, I don't think that Judaism is all or nothing.
Okay.
I happen to have taken a path where I've ended up taking on all. Although there are still things, by the way, that my friends who are Orthodox do, and I'm just not so into. I'm not, like, for me, prayer is very hard. I do the minimum and then I walk away, right? I have other things that I do. But for me, it's not all or nothing. And for example, with my students on campus, which is mostly what I do now, I work for Jewish Arizonans on Campus, which is an amazing Jewish organization. I'm really introducing Jewish students to their heritage. So in that work, I work with secular students and I say to them, listen, what's your question? And there's a reason why I ask that. Why? Because I feel like I bring tools. I bring tools and I bring opportunities. So I need to know, what do you want to achieve? Okay, once we've worked out what do you want to achieve, now I'm going to look into my toolbox and see, okay, do I have any tools that I can show you in order to achieve that? And it's not an all or nothing game. Like, there'll be one girl who's working on waking up in the morning and saying a mantra that just helps her appreciate the fact that she opened her eyes and she woke up, just to get her over that, like, terrible morning, right? There's another girl who is who's struggling with friends who are depressed and just doesn't have anything else to do. So I said, you know what, why don't you take on doing one extra positive thing and you can dedicate it to them. You know, you might not be able to help yourself, but, like, at least you'll feel like you're doing something. I have girls who struggle all the time with boys on campus. I mean, as you know, like, some people have thrown around the statistic of 1 in 5 girls is sexually assaulted on campus. It's a little bit of a controversial statistic, but it's certainly pretty high. Like, how does Torah and Judaism relate to dating apps like Tinder? How can I learn to set boundaries? Okay, I'm an Orthodox Jewish woman. I definitely have boundaries. But the principle of setting a boundary, saying this far and no further, is really important.
But Hannah, do you think you would have been able to express that without your secular past as well? Do you think the combination that you've lived, being Orthodox and secular, helps you give more insights to young women who may say, they may have asked you the same questions I did at the beginning? How can you put these together?
Right. I think there are some people who would think that someone like me looks back on their life and says, oh my gosh, I'm so ashamed of all the terrible things that I did when I was secular. You know, for me, I'm very, very proud of my journey, of everything that I've learned. I think that that adds to, as you said, I think that adds to what I do and my education. Yet I work with a lot of other rabbis' wives who did grow up Orthodox, and they also do amazing things with their students. And I think that goes back to your original question of individuality. I think that we're all so individual. Different people connect to different ideas. They just come from a different perspective than me.
I only have about 30 seconds left. Do you think it is more challenging in this high-tech world, 24/7 news cycle, iPads, cell phones, etc., to live the life you've chosen to live, and when younger people ask you about it? Or is that just generations change and that's how we deal with it?
I don't think it's more challenging. I think it's more important. I just think that if we can take some of these ideas and start to put them into our lives, we can enjoy our iPads and our 24-hour news cycles and our crazy hectic lives, and we can actually enjoy it. And instead of us being slaves to our iPhones and our Facebooks, we can use them to do incredible things.
Hannah Goldstein is the blogger behind Reclaiming Pink. She's a feminist, also a member of the Orthodox Jewish denomination, as we found out today, married to a rabbi. Hannah, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Blogger Hannah Goldstein of Reclaiming Pink. We originally spoke in September. Coming up on this special edition of KJZZ's Here and Now, conversations from 2015 with musician Roseanne Cash and humorist Lori Natero. Stay tuned. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. On this year-end edition of the program, we're listening back to our favorite conversations of 2015. In February, I spoke with singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. She had just won 3 Grammys for her album The River and the Thread. Cash is the daughter of the legendary Johnny Cash, but has carved out a successful solo career and in collaboration with her husband, John Leventhal. We started our conversation by talking about whether it feels more important to have your heart honored when you've been in the business for a long period of time.
It does. I won a Grammy when I was 30, and I remember feeling nervous about it, that it felt like a lot of pressure, like I really had to prove something after then. Oddly, I think some people have the opposite reaction. But this time, 30-something years later, I just felt that I was being recognized for showing up for work for 30-something years. You know, if nothing else, I'm very persistent. I mean, I do think this is that we did some good work on this record, and it was really satisfying to have it recognized like that.
I don't know if the phrase aha moment or eureka moment is too pat or trite now, but what does that feel like when you're working on a song? Because clearly this is not some overnight thing. You don't just wake up and you love the song. It's a process. So when it comes to that, can you recognize the aha moment even if you've been working on a song for a month?
Oh, yeah. That moment is so great. It's addictive. You know, it's the same as writing a novel or painting a painting. And I've heard a lot of different artists speak about this, visual artists, writers of all kinds, that you start with not knowing. You start with this very scary sense of just being unsure and not knowing where it's going to go or what it is exactly, but you have an image or you have a phrase or you have a melody. And so you start and you make a commitment to it and you move through it. And then at some point, like you said, there's that moment where you know what it is and you just have to bring your skills to finish it. That's the experience I've had with every song I've ever written. And sometimes it's very powerful, visceral even, and sometimes it's just a gentle kind of awakening to what it is. I've heard other songwriters say, and I kind of believe this too, that songs are already written out in the ether somewhere, you know, and it just depends on how good your catcher's mitt is.
How vital was the collaboration with your husband on The River and the Thread?
It was essential. It was a total collaboration with him. He wrote the music. I wrote the lyrics. We made this record together. We took all the trips together through the Delta and Appalachia that inspired the record. You know, at one point in the process of making the record, I said, you know, your name needs to be on the album cover as well. And he goes, no, you know, I don't need that. He doesn't really care about being, you know, front and center in the spotlight. But it was a collaboration. And that in itself was so satisfying, really special.
I did want to ask you about a couple of songs. One is A Feather Is Not a Bird. Can you just talk about that song and what you felt when you were writing it?
I had written the chorus before we wrote the rest of the song. I had the chorus for quite a while. Feather's not a bird, rain is not the sea, stone is not a mountain, but a river runs through me.
Feather's not a bird, the rain is not the sea, the stone is not a mountain, but a river runs through me.
And I had written this kind of girly melody to it, you know, but I didn't like it. It was just kind of flat. And then John and I took this trip where we drove from Memphis to Florence, Alabama, and then back through Mississippi and back to Memphis. And my girlfriend, Natalie Channon, who lives in Florence, she was teaching me to sew. I wanted to learn to sew, and she has this company called Alabama Channon and hand sews these beautiful clothes. And she said that line when she was threading my needle. She said, you have to love the thread. And it chilled me. She wasn't even speaking in metaphor, but it chilled me, and I kept thinking about that as we drove back to Memphis. You know, and that I have family scattered through the South, and that both of my parents were Southerners, and we went to Arkansas where my dad grew up, and I kept thinking of that line, you have to love the thread, and that opened up the song. And then John had this melody that was much more muscular than my girly little melody for the chorus.
I took the long way home just to end up in your arms.
And that song opens the album, and it kind of lays out the landscape for the rest of the album.
Sunken Lands is another one that really hit me. What's the background on that one?
Sunken Lands is the area in Arkansas where my dad grew up. It's called the Sunken Lands because in 19th century earthquake, the land there in that part of the Delta sank. It actually sank around the Mississippi.
Oh, wow.
It was one of the strongest earthquakes ever registered in the country. So ever since then, the area is called the Sunken Lands.
The river rises and she sails away. She could never stay. Whoa, whoa. There's 5 empty cans.
I was thinking about my grandmother and how hard her life was, and they were cotton farmers, and she raised 7 children, and no electricity. And I just started thinking, you know, she was such a tenacious woman, and I'm a modern woman. I live in New York City. I have every creature comfort, you know. What is it in me that survives of her? Trying to pinpoint that. So the Sunken Lands is really about her.
We've already talked about how hard you've worked and even, as you said, some luck in your career. Were you born to be a great musician in some sense? Is there that feeling that was something that was in your destiny, or is that something that's fluff and you had to work your butt off to make that happen?
That's the big question, isn't it? I tend to think that it's half hard work, half DNA, because it's not just my dad, but you know, I can trace some of what he did and what I do back to those mournful Celtic songs. You know, our family came from Scotland in the 17th century, and I think there must have been Celtic musicians, because those minor chords and some of the mournful quality of what we both do in different ways, you know, it's got to be traced back to the Celts. So that, and his grandfather was a church choir leader, you know, a singer in that fashion. So I think about that and how music is currency in my family, and that we trade in songs, and there's a song for everything that happens and every feeling. And I think, well, that's part of who we are, just as generations of doctors, you know, or firemen, that's who they are as a family. And then the other part is, yeah, I have worked hard. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect it to come for free, whatever I've done. And I also learned that my father had a very powerful work ethic, and I inherited that from him. So, you know, I think it's both.
Last question for you. You've, as we said, it's been a great 2014. You had an amazing album come out. You were honored by the Grammys. So what, if there's not too much pressure, what's next?
Well, I'm doing something really exciting this year and next, which is that Carnegie Hall asked me to curate a series. And they said, you know, you can do it on any theme you want. And I said, well, Southern Roots music. You know, I wanted to bring more Southern Roots music to Carnegie Hall. So I curated 4 shows for the 15-16 season. And that starts in October with Ry Cooter and Ricky Skaggs, which is going to be fantastic.
Wow.
And that was a great honor. You know, it's like, I felt like, wow, I've really arrived now. It's not the Grammys. It's like being asked to curate at Carnegie Hall. That was a big deal.
Roseanne Cash, thank you so much for the time. It was very nice to talk with you.
It's a pleasure talking to you too. Thank you.
Musician Roseanne Cash, we spoke in February. You're listening to a year-end edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. There are a lot of things to make fun of in Arizona, which I guess is why humorist Lori Notaro left the valley for the Pacific Northwest. She comes back periodically to make fun of the rest of us, enjoy authentic Mexican food, and to teach humor writing. When we talked with Notaro in September, she had just released a new collection of some of her vintage writing. It's called Enter Pirates. I started the interview by asking Notaro how she teaches others to write humorously when she has such a unique voice.
Well, you know, the thing was, is when I taught classes kind of like at ASU at Lane Community College up in Eugene, and when they were saying, you know, like, teach a writing class. At first, I was like, the same thing. I was like, you can't do that. You just have to, either you have to do, like, a lot of drugs, or you have to have some, like, you know, inner problems, a really bad childhood, which I did not have that, Mom. My mother's listening. I had a great childhood. She was awesome. But when I actually started to sit down and think about it, I thought, oh my God, if you deconstruct it, if you take a joke, like how I start my classes is I take a David Sedaris joke and I say, what word makes this funny? Why is this funny? Let's really think about this and take it apart. And once you do that, it completely makes sense to me how things are funny. You just take something that's true and you twist it just a little bit and add a little bit of embarrassment or a little bit of an exaggeration, and you pretty much always hit the spot. So that's how it works.
I'm not sure if anybody cares what I think about this, but when I read your stuff, what makes it so funny to me is that it feels like this is the real person. It feels like you're getting stuff out there, that you have developed your unique voice. So, you know, can you encourage people to do that? How long did it take? I mean, do you feel like you are comfortable with this humorous voice?
Yeah, well, it's me.
Yeah, good. That's it. Yeah.
This is everyday me. This is, you know, my parents are both really funny people. They don't know that, but they are. They're hilarious. And what I really want to do is I want to do a blog between my parents and myself every morning. But I can't figure out how to tape them without my mother figuring out that I'm taping her. And now the gig is up. It's just, they're going to know that. But they're both really funny. So I grew up in a very, you know, we're Italian American. They're Catholic, so there's that repression. You're always dirty. You're always bad. You're going to hell. It's like that kind of thing. So I guess it was just a natural reaction for me to try to deflect some of that stuff and either not care about it or make fun of it. And then I got fat, and I really had to figure out a way of how to deal with that and Spanx and the summertime and sweat and make it funny so it was actually livable.
Now, this is a daytime public radio show, but I'm going to risk reading the title of one of your stories in Enter Pirates, which is called That Bitch from the Paper.
Yeah.
Which focuses on how everyone hates you. Now,
that's true.
Did they really hate you? And if so, why did they hate you?
I didn't even know this. And this is when I was writing for the State Press at ASU. And I used to go to Long Wong's when Long Wong's was the big bar on Mill Avenue back in the heyday when Long Wong's was there and Mill Avenue was still cool and the Jim Blossoms and Dead Hot Workshop were playing. And I walked in one day and I interrupted two of my friends who were both in bands, and they were saying, you know, oh my God, my girlfriend hates you. And then Mark Zubia said, oh my God, my girlfriend hates you too. And I was like, what? Why do your girlfriends hate me? And they're like, everyone hates you. And I was like, really? Because I didn't think that I was that terrible or nasty, but I think there was just something about being out there, I suppose. I mean, they're not jealous of my beauty. Let's just put it that way. You know, it's not like I'm not Angelina Jolie. You know, there's no reason to be jealous of me on that level. But I think that maybe because I had a voice and maybe because I was a little bit obnoxious and I didn't really care what people thought, it was taken as a bit of maybe bravado. I don't know.
Well, now, were you hated, I'm putting in quotes, were you hated by males and females? Because I was wondering if you're just...
Oh, girls.
Maybe you're just like a guy's girl. Like, you can hang out, you can be yourself, tell jokes.
Yeah, I could drink with the rest of them, I guess. So so that was fine. But the girls in particular, the ones who didn't know me, I mean, I certainly had some friends in that, you know, in that scene. But for the most part, people just really, the girls didn't care for me at all.
Now, this is a huge collection of stories, but one more that stood out to me is Permed, which obviously the way you tell everything is hilarious, but what about this one? Why was this one? Because this is something that a lot of mostly females have experienced, this feeling about after they get permed.
I don't know. My hair is naturally curly. My mother will tell you that it's not, but it is. And it took me like 40 years to realize that. So like in the 90s, I'm like, I'm going to perm my hair. And then it turned out crazy. And then I realized I went to when ABCO was still here,
sure.
I realized that I had ABCO hair. Like I had all the
ABCO
hair.
ABCO is an old supermarket. Yeah.
Now it was Alpha Beta. Now it's all Safeway. But I realized that I had the same hair as all the cashiers in downtown Phoenix. And I was like, oh my God. So I had to re-perm my hair the same day and straighten it out, and then it just turned into corn husk hair. So that was...
Yeah, but what a friend of yours gave you some tips in there, and they didn't sound like cheap tips either.
It was Laura Greenberg from Phoenix Magazine. I was interning at the time, and she was like, okay, now you need to do, because everyone had done it. She's got naturally curly hair too, and she had been permed. So it was crazy. I'm so glad that pressure on women is over. That era is over for now. Permed. It'll probably come back in 5 years, but for now we're safe. We're okay.
So Enter Pirates is 1991 to 1999.
Yeah.
Now, I'm guessing you're not the one who saved all these columns. So maybe you were.
No, I wasn't. There was, you know, when I started at State Press, this was 1991, we didn't have email. There was no such thing. Yeah. I was working on green screen computers. So, and I'm a lazy person by nature, so I wasn't saving any of my stuff on floppies. I saved parts of it, but then I didn't save everything. So I had some hard copies of the State Press. I mean, by now, they're like 30 years old. And then in different moves, and then we had a flood in the basement, and all those hard copies got lost. And my grandmother died 7 years ago, and because we're a family of denial, we kept her house completely intact for 7 years until my sister moved into it earlier this summer, and she was like, oh my God, I just found this Giorgio Armani bag of all of your columns that Nana had saved through all of these years.
Wow.
And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. And so she sent me some, and I was like, you know what? These aren't too bad. But it was like kind of playing This Is Your Life. You know, I was just like, oh my God, I had been permed. I didn't remember that. Like, people hated me at Long Long's. I didn't remember that. So it was like kind of like flashbacks of all these crazy things. And I thought, you know what? Let me put these together and see how they do, because Random House had just put Idiot Girls, which was my first book, 2002 release, on an ebook special on Amazon and iTunes, and that book 15 years later went back on the New York Times list. 15 years
later. See, that means other people are going to start hating you now because of that.
I mean, I didn't make any money from it.
Yeah,
you know, don't think that. But it got back up there. So that made me think, yeah, that people still do want to hear about that really irresponsible borderline alcoholic Lori Notaro. So we did it.
Humorist Lori Notaro, we spoke in September. That's all for this special year-end edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help in 2015. And thank you very much for listening. You can find our past interviews and segments at kjzz.org, or you can download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. I'm Steve Goldstein. Happy New Year.